Good morning, everyone. My name is Bea and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is the 2nd of December, 1978. And I have a home group and I have a sponsor. In fact, I just talked to my sponsor about 20 minutes ago and prayed with her on the phone. Before I begin my most favorite topic, which is myself, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, Sandy, for inviting me. This is one of my most favorite parts of the whole world. I know a lot of you here. I do a lot of different things up in these areas, and I'm delighted to reconnect with you. And I really have no clue why you'd want to be spending a Sunday morning listening to me again. You're probably sicker than most, but it's your problem and it's not mine. I appreciated so much what Bruce had to say about him being an oversensitive alcoholic, and I just had a spiritual awakening as he said that, because I know that I belong to the same ilk as he does. Anyway, my story is really boring, and I always wanted to have a story like this. I really did. I always wanted to have a story where I lived out of a car, and I was homeless, and all kinds of bad things happened. And it's very, very boring. But I have to tell you that my alcoholism showed itself a way long, way back far. Now, take a good look at me. And if I tell you that my story begins when I was 2, you know you're going to be here for the rest of the day. So just relax, and I'll try not to have my feelings hurt if you leave. And I'll do the best I can to carry whatever God wants me to say here, because I don't have a clue. My story did begin when I was 2, because when I was 2, my sister was born. And that meant that she moved into the spot that belonged to me. And my spot was the center of the universe, always has been. And if I'm not working a solid program these days, I can still revert to that state where I'm in charge and I'm important and it's all about me. And I didn't like her because she was opposite to me. She was just real different. And it seemed like in her presence that I felt, because of my oversensitivity, I felt that I was being pushed to the periphery of this family unit. And then these parents of mine in Ireland went on having babies every year. That's what they do in Ireland every year. And we ended up with 5 of us. And, you know, every time a new child came into the family, it felt like I was less and less belonging. And I was to come to Alcoholics Anonymous a long, long time afterwards to learn that part of my problem and part of the disease that manifests itself to me these days is that I don't fit too well. I just fit real well here in these rooms with you people, and because I know now who I am, and I also know some of the solutions, thanks be to God. So we had 5 of us by this time, and my parents had built this wonderful granite house overlooking a river, and I felt this little lonely girl. At the same time, I had some happy memories of those first 8 years of my life, until a tragic thing happened in our family, and that was that my father went to work one day and he never came home. He was killed in an accident, and it was tragic. And just a tragic aura came over our whole family unit. And on the day of my dad's funeral, to which I was not allowed to attend, my mother took me aside and she said this to me: "Bea, I want you to help me to raise these children." And I remember distinctly what I did. I put away all my playthings, my dolls, and all the things you do as a little 8-year-old girl. And I started about this business called growing up. Now, those of you who are in the audience this morning know me well enough, and you know that this has not happened to me yet. But there's probably a chance that if I stick around with you and I stay around with you people, that I might have a chance of being able to grow up a little bit emotionally. But I started to grow up in other kinds of ways. My mother was, in fact, she's extremely well described on page 61 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she taught us all this. Is he not, it says on page 61, or is she not a victim of the delusion that she can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if she only manages well? Now, I looked the word rest up in the dictionary, and the definition is to push and pull in a violent fashion. So I don't suppose any of you here have ever rested, but I have, and again, when I'm not working a good program, I continue to rest, which is to push and pull in a violent fashion. And so my mother taught us that the main objective of life and living was to manage well. And so she taught us everything she knew. She was widowed at 32, and she was a school teacher, and she cooked and cleaned and sewed and educated us. And her big value was that we would all be educated so that we wouldn't be widowed at 32 like she was. And so with that kind of a background, and for those of you who may be new, you may wonder why I would even mention any of these things. And if you'd want to turn to page 64 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll see there at the very top of the page that it tells this extraordinary thing, that alcohol is not our problem at all. I was so baffled by this when I came to the program, that what we have to do after we get rid of the alcohol, what we have to do is we have to get down to the causes and conditions. And I really thought that the steps were something you would work up towards. And what I've learned now is that I have to work down to the steps, because I have to go deep down within to find out who in God's name I might even be. And so with this mindset and mentality that I needed to manage well, and I needed to do something significant in my life, I started to think about what I would want to do when I would grow up. And in my teenage years and finishing high school, well, what I decided to do was to become a saint. Now, again, enough of you here know me, and you know that this has not happened to me yet either. But in trying to become a saint, what I decided to do was to become a Catholic nun. Now, I became a Catholic nun in 1950, so you can tell I'm one of the older members of my community. I just am amazed at why so many of you would want to come on a Sunday morning and listen to a Catholic nun. Because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that many of you here sitting looking at me now have a resentment against people like me. Just know that. I have this intuitive sense, you know, that that's possibly true. And I just need to say this to you. One, that I probably didn't do it to you. So, you know, you take me off the hook. And I also want to say this to you, that if any of you have ever been hurt or shamed or embarrassed or abused in any way by a woman in my line of work, I want to humbly and sincerely apologize to you. I also want to apologize to any of you who have been hurt by any member of the church to which I belong. And take that off you when you hear somebody saying it publicly. Well, I know now that in these days that the Pope is going around, or has been going around the world, apologizing for the problems in the church. And my take on that is that I think he heard about me. And that I was doing it, you know, and I thought he'd better get with the program here. And you know, I learned an amazing thing when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was this, and please forgive me if this offends any of you. I've learned this, that there are assholes everywhere. You know that. Um, there's Catholic assholes and Baptist assholes and Lutheran assholes and Presbyterian assholes and Jewish assholes. And, in fact, to tell you the truth, there are a few assholes in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've met. None of you, nobody here, of course, but, you know, where I've been all over the world. And I don't know this for a fact, but there might be one or two in Al-Anon. I'm not sure. I would really doubt that, you know. I mean, I don't think so. They're too nice to be assholes. But what I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen, is that human institutions make human mistakes. And often in human institutions, human mistakes are not publicly acknowledged. And I sincerely want to acknowledge my deep, deep regret for any of you who may have been hurt or offended by anybody in the denomination to which I belong. And so I started into this nunny business a long time ago now, 55 years almost. And it was wonderful. And believe me when I tell you that it still is. It's still wonderful. And I had no intention at all of ever becoming an alcoholic. All I knew was that I was going to be a saint with my name written in books and pictures of me, and you could pray to me and about me and talk about me. And, oh, God, it was fabulous. And so the nuns, I was in Ireland and in our mother house, and then finally when I made my profession of vows, they sent me over to finish my education in England, in the University of London, and I did that and did well and became a teacher. Was teaching in England, and fabulous life, you know, teaching kids, opening their minds, delighted with myself. I just thought this was the greatest thing in the world, and I was so happy. And for those of you here who are in Al-Anon, you'll recognize this little voice that went off in my head after some time. And the voice said something like this: if only they could be anybody, if only they would shape up, I would feel better. Now, they could be the other nuns with whom I was living. They could be the other members of the staff where I was teaching. It could be the school principal. It could be the government. It could be anybody, actually. And I didn't know, you know, what this little head meant, this little problem was, and I got very disconnected, and I felt restless, irritable, and discontent, and I couldn't understand. And an amazing thing happened one day when we were invited to volunteer to come to California. Well, now, you know, I knew that I belonged in Hollywood from the day one, so in fact, I hope I'll be home in time for the Oscars tonight, but so I volunteered, and I got picked. And they were sending me to California to start this new venture here. And on my way out, I had to go back to Ireland to do all my paperwork. And on my way out, when I was just leaving, my superior, this is how they used to do things in the old days, she just tapped me on the shoulder, and she said this to me: "Sister, we're going to put you in charge." Well, now, you know that there's nothing better that a budding alcoholic who hasn't had a drink yet loves to hear, and continues to love to hear this, that you're going to be in charge. Because we do believe that that's part of our, you know, that's the necessity for us in life, to become in charge. And so I set off for California in August of 1964, dressed in all the nunny clothes. You know how we used to look? Some of you will remember us in the long black serge, and white linen all over our heads and faces, and all you could see was our face and our two hands, and it was very, very hot. But I was going to be in charge, and nothing mattered more than that. And so it all went well for several days. I was beginning everything, you know, beginning a school principal, all the little nunny bunnies running around me, and I was their boss. Oh, it was just incredible. And I was in charge. And this man appeared after a couple of days, and he introduced himself to me as the pastor. And he made it clear to me that he was in charge. Now, this was not going to be working for me, you know, how this would happen. And I started to plan his demise between my ears. And I thought, what if I wrote a letter to the cardinal? And of course, in those days, I behaved very nicely. You know, he didn't know that I was absolutely consumed with anger and resentment from the minute I set eyes on him. But I tried really well to do the nunny thing, which is smile sweetly and say, screw you. But I tried not to do that out loud. And try to work this thing out. Now, if you're feeling like this and all those little orphaned feelings, there's no other word that I can think that describes me better, those little not belonging orphaned feelings, which can return quite well even in recovery. When you're feeling like this and a lady comes to my office door and she invites all of us over to swim at her swimming pool, and we all go over there, and I'm a swimmer, so I was delighted with myself, and we were over there, swam, had a great time. And she came to the side of the pool with a tray and a large pitcher, and there were glasses, and on the top of the glasses there was salt. Well, I can hear from some of your chuckles that you probably know what was in the pitcher. In some places in the world, they don't know this. They don't know what a margarita tastes like. And I believe that you don't belong here yet until you know what that feels like. It's an amazing. So I took a large draft of this wonderful beverage that she provided for us. And then I filled my glass up again. And I had my very first and best spiritual awakening. And I knew that in order for me to survive and to live comfortably in my own skin with unresolved problems, that I needed to have this beverage on a regular basis. I'm sure that those of you who had your first drink will recognize this feeling of, you know that this is going to work. And I knew then that I worked too hard, I didn't relax enough, I was too intense about everything. And so if I could have this little thing every once in a while, it could help me to feel the difference between a cactus plant and velvet. You know, that just, every part of me hurt, you know, inside and outside. And then when I would have this little beverage, it made me feel nice and smooth and even and balanced and like velvet. And so when I was leaving, I said to the lady, could we please have the recipe to take home? So she gave me, the boss lady, the recipe. And so I thought the nicest thing that I could do for these nuns who worked so hard because they worked for me, I thought the nicest thing that I could do on a regular basis would be to whip this deal up if I could get the ingredients. Now, that wasn't always so easy, and I wish that in those days that I'd met some of you, because I know you would have helped me out here. But it was difficult to find my spots, you know, where I could get the ingredients and wouldn't have to hide and I wouldn't have to tell lies. And I'd say to the sisters regularly, are you tired? And they would say, oh, we're exhausted. You know, they were always tired. They work for me. So then I'd say, well, let's have a little celebration this evening. Now, I thought that the word celebration had a sort of a liturgical note, you know. I thought that I never thought of saying, let's all get drunk this evening. Those words didn't come to mind. But I thought a little celebration was just in order. And I learned from the word go that their notion of celebration and mine was different. When they celebrate with me, and we had a little breakout, you know, and we broke out a little glass of whatever we could get our hands on, they were very different from me. They would sip. Now, I don't know if you've ever been around sippers. They're very boring people to be around. And they would hold their glasses with their little finger out like this, and they would not finish, which in my book is the only sin that there really is. You know, you don't waste this good stuff. And they wasted good stuff. Well, they thought they did, but when they were all done, I would come around and take their leftovers and put it into something where I could stash it away for the rainy day. And there were many of those rainy days in my life. And that's why I wish I'd met some of you then, but actually I don't. But it's a kind of a fantasy I have every once in a while. You know, it would have been fun, maybe. And so my drinking career began, and it started to progress. Now, I was a very careful drinker. In fact, I did for many, many years what chapter 3 says we cannot do. I tried very, very hard to control and enjoy my drinking. I tried to do the two things at the same time. And what I learned was that when I controlled my drinking, I could never enjoy it. And when I enjoyed my drinking, I could never control it. And what I had to learn when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it was the great obsession of every abnormal drinker that somehow, someday, we'd be able to do this. And I spent many, many years trying to get that thing organized, you know, evenly balanced. And what I did in trying to do this, which I'm sure many of you did too, I decided that I would pray more. And so I did. Oh, I prayed so hard that not that I would stop drinking, but that I would be able to get this nice velvet feeling and not be involved in what our book calls the phenomenon of craving all night and at 2 o'clock in the morning walking up and down the halls wondering where I was going to find a drink in the convent. You know, that's a terrible, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization in my life, in my line of work. And so what I decided to do was, I know what I'll do. I'll make a 30-day retreat. And I will go in silence and fasting for almost 30 days. And so what I did was I came to a place up in it probably wasn't too far from here, but I went with a group of other nuns, and the priest was directing us, and I remember on about the 15th day, he told us that we could have what was called a break day, and we didn't have to do any of the retreat exercises at all, and he said we could even go out and do whatever it was we needed to do or wanted to do that day. And the other people who lived up in that area said to me, is there any place special that you would like to go? And I said, yes, I would like to go and visit the Napa Valley. Now, you see, I thought that if I did that, that was becoming kind of cultured. You know what I mean? That you didn't come to Northern California and not do that. So we went to the Napa Valley and we visited as many wineries as I could possibly see on the road anywhere. And we drank our little samples from those godforsaken little glasses. You know how small they are. And however, I had enough of them, and then when I came home, I just knew that that was a great day. That 15th day was a great day. And I had to go back right into the exercises of the retreat the next year, but I knew that at the end of the retreat that probably I'd be able to get this thing down, where I wouldn't be craving alcohol all the time and that I wouldn't be doing embarrassing things. On the 30th day, I was thirstier than I had ever been for my whole life, and I knew that I had to have something more to drink. One of my favorite places for drinking was Mexico. We had a family who owned a little trailer down there in Estero Beach, and maybe I drank with some of you down there, and I'm glad to meet you today. And the gentleman and his wife weren't using it very much then, and they brought the keys over to the convent one day, and they gave them to me, and they said, you know, you guys work so hard, and we'd love to use this place because we hardly ever use it anymore. And he handed me the keys, And he said, this is the key of the front door. And there was another key, the key of the cabana. And then he held up a little key and he said, and this is the key of the liquor cabinet. Help yourself. And I said, praise God from whom all blessings flow. And I said to the nanny bunnies, you know what? We have to get down to Mexico as often as we possibly can to learn how to speak Spanish. I thought I was going down to learn how to speak Spanish with all the Canadians and Americans who lived in Estero Beach. But what I was going down was to use his little key so that I could get what I needed to get that feeling from cactus to velvet. That's really what I wanted to do. And the nuns used to say to me, do you think we should be drinking his alcohol? And I would say, we're eating his cereal, aren't we? We don't want to hurt his feelings. You know, he's our host, and, you know, we wouldn't want him to think we were ungrateful. And so on long weekends and short weekends and long holidays, I was always very impressed with the United States of America because there's a holiday in nearly every single month of the year. And so we'd go down there as regularly as possible. And what I remember was that I remember what I went down to do. Now I do, but I didn't know then. I really didn't know. And my drinking career continued. And I began to do what a lot of us did in this room, I'm sure. I began to do the dying that only we know, the dying that happens to us inside. That terrible feeling of, who am I going to turn to? Where am I going to go? And I always like to just ask now, if you can remember where you were when your moment happened to you, when you knew that you had to get some help, and you knew that you could no longer continue to go as you were going. I thought Bruce described it really well when he told us, you know, where he was and how he just couldn't go another step further. And I was standing in my living room in the convent. It was called the community room. And I didn't know who I was ever going to ask. I knew I couldn't talk to the pastor because I hated his guts. And I knew I couldn't tell the other sisters because I was in charge of everything and everybody. And I didn't know where I would go and what I would do. And I was just standing there, helpless and hopeless, and didn't know it was called powerlessness. I didn't know that. And I walked over just at random to the bookshelf in our community room. And I pulled off this little booklet, this little pamphlet, and just turned the pages over to the very last page. I didn't hardly know what I was doing. And on the very back page of this book, it was a book that was published for nuns, and it said, Sister, are you concerned about your drinking? If so, call the following number, collect. Now, out of the 140,000 nuns in the United States, I thought there must be one other none who had a problem besides myself. You see, I was very, very unique and very, very special. And so I thought I was the only one. So I made a phone call to Massachusetts at 9 o'clock at night in California. It was midnight their time. And a real live voice came on the phone, which would not be the case today, I'm sure. It would be, you know, a recording and the menu has changed and give you the whole menu and then they play some music for you and then they tell you in another language and then by then I would have hung up, you see. But God so ordained that there was a real live voice at the other side of the phone at midnight in Massachusetts. And she said, can I help you? And I told her that I was concerned about other people's drinking. Now, I'm sure that you've never lied. I'm sure you've never told lies, but I had to do that. I had to tell her that I was moving into a new job, and that was true. I was moving from the job I was in the school as principal to a diocesan position, which was highly prestigious and it was highly, a lot of responsibility involved. And I knew a lot of these guys I was going to be working with did have drinking problems. At least they looked like they had. They had become my lower companions, if you understand what I mean. And they procured my alcohol. And so I was concerned about them, I told her. And she listened to me, and she told me that she would give me some help for them. and she would send me pamphlets, and she told me about a recovery home that she was there in, organized for priests and nuns, and she even had some bishops there, she said. And she talked to me really sensibly and intelligently. And I just knew if she could send me some literature that I would be able to catch on to how you could control and enjoy your drinking. I could learn how to do this. It would be like going on a diet, you know? And she said this to me just before we hung up. Sister, would you like to tell me a little bit about your own drinking? Because I can hear pain in your voice. Now, can you believe the way that God works, the mysterious way that God works, that this woman whom I'd never met in Massachusetts at midnight, and I'm in California at 9 o'clock, and she could hear the pain in my voice. And when she said she could hear the pain in my voice, I broke down into the phone, and I don't know what I said, but I know I did try to impress her. I told her that I used to be big. I was telling this to Larry yesterday. I used to be very big into impression management. Thanks be to God for the relief of that in my life today. In addition to not having to have a drink, you know, not to have to worry about impression management. In those days, I told her how many degrees I had, how many jobs I'd had, how important I was, and oh my goodness. And she listened, and she listened, and she listened. And she said to me, well, you know, it seems to me that you wouldn't be calling at midnight from California to Massachusetts if you're just concerned about somebody else. And she said, with all the loving concern that I have for another human being, I am asking you to go to an AA meeting and listen for the similarities instead of to the differences. And then she said something extraordinary to an Irish woman. She said, of course, she said, it's kind of like getting on an elevator, excuse me, and you can get off at any floor you want. And she said, you don't have to go down the whole way to the bottom, but maybe you are not ready. Now, you tell an Irish woman that she's not ready, and she's going to show you, even if you live in Massachusetts, that she is ready. And she's going to prove to you that she can do this. And so the next morning, I made a phone call to a central office in Los Angeles, and I found a meeting in a place called Whittier, which is quite a distance from where I live in Orange County. And I drove to an AA meeting at 10 a.m. in the morning, the meeting was, on a Wednesday morning. I will never, ever forget it. Now, in those days, we were wearing a kind of a little modified nunny habit. I took off my nunny clothes, I put on regular clothes, and I put on some green eye makeup that I had bought in Kmart. Well, I was gorgeous 26 years ago. And I drove down to Serenity Hall in Whittier. Now, the name was attractive to me, but when I went and saw what Serenity Hall really was, it wasn't very attractive to me. It was like a little hole in the wall. Some of you might have been there. And it was, the smoke came right down to here, you know. And it seemed to me, none of this need necessarily be true, but this is my perception. It seemed to me there were a lot of little old men just shuffling through Serenity Hall. And there were two women, and one left and one stayed. And the one who stayed was, as we say in Ireland, she was not the full shilling. She laughed at the wrong times, and she clapped at the wrong times, and she was really gone, or, you know, a taco short of a combination plate. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't know that I'm fitting real well in here. And then a fellow got up to the podium to share his experience, strength, and hope with us. And, of course, I didn't know any different. I thought he must be the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know how you don't know things. And there was a podium somewhat like this, and the Serenity Prayer was draped around the front. And he stood and he started telling us about himself. And he was fascinating to me because he was using words that I was unfamiliar with using on a regular basis in sentences like he could, you know. he was using a word quite regularly that began with sh, which you may or may not ever have heard here. But what was even more fascinating to me was that he moved from that into the th word. Now, I could not believe my ears, you know. Here's St. Bee with her green eye makeup on, sitting in Serenity Hall in Whittier, and he's using the F word in every possible part of speech. A noun, a verb, an adjective, an adverb, a preposition, a conjunction. He used it with ing on the end, with er at the end, with ed at the end, and once he used it with the word mother before it. Now, you know, I thought, and this is going to be my spiritual leader for the rest of my life. So I got in the car to go home after this was over, and I thought, I don't think I can do this. I don't think so. There was something happened, though, when we said the Lord's Prayer together, you know, that, and I'm looking around here, and there's all sorts of people that I had never met anything like them before. And I'm thinking, these are not my sort, you know. I don't think I can stay here. And I get in the car to go home, and at the stop sign, like some of us do, I looked at myself in the mirror, and of course by this time I was crying from fear, resentment, anger, not wanting to be there, and frustration, terrible frustration, and this eye makeup that I put on was rolling down my face, and I said the sh word and the f word all the way home to the convent. Now, not advocating this necessarily, but I'm telling you that when you're desperate and you really don't know that lack of power is your dilemma and you don't want to do this thing at all like it's laid out, you don't want to. Now, I need you to know this from the very beginning, that I have a tremendous problem with surrender. You know, I come from the north of Ireland. Surrender is illegal in the north of Ireland. You know that? You don't surrender if you come from the north of Ireland. In fact, the graffiti that people write on the walls is no surrender. And you either fight until you win or you fight until you die. So it's in my blood and in my bones not to surrender. And so they're saying things to me in these meetings, say, you have to let go, B. You've got to let go. I'm thinking, how do you let go? And then they say, well, you just hang on. You know, none of this stuff makes sense to me. And I am a really, really reluctant participant in this deal called sobriety. Now, you don't have to do it this way, and I don't recommend it, but I didn't know how to do it any other way. I scratched and clawed, and they were basically telling me five things. They were saying, don't drink. Well, actually, that's not exactly the way they said it in Serenity Hall. This is what they used to say. Don't drink no matter what, even if your ass falls off. Now, there was a woman who used to come to some of the meetings, and she used to say this. Don't drink no matter what, even if your ass falls off. And if it does, put it in a bag and take it to a meeting. Now, I ask you, please, do they know that I'm a graduate from the University of London? You know, and they're telling me to put my ass in a bag and take it to a meeting. You know, I mean, that's not what I grew up to become, you know. And then they were saying, don't use any mind-altering drugs, and I wasn't involved in some good stuff that's around today. But I did have open prescriptions for Librium, Valium, Elevil, and Celsine. And when I swilled that down with a little bit of whatever I could do, it made me feel like the music on Twilight Zone. Na 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 na, you know, the lights are on, but there's nobody home, you know. I'm out there somehow, somewhere. Alcohol was the drug of my choice, and I stopped taking the prescription drugs voluntarily, kind of, you know. And I wasn't that interested. I just loved alcohol. So they were saying, don't drink. Go to meetings. And I didn't think that anything at meetings would enhance what I already had, because I had all this information. I had all this God stuff. I'd been, oh, God, I knew so much about God. It was incredible. And I had the difference, as I'll mention later, probably the difference between an arrangement and a relationship. I had a real good arrangement with God, but no relationship. And then they were telling me to read the book, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I hope I won't offend you when I tell you this, that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I read it first, was the worst piece of literature I ever read in my whole life. You know, the sentences are not too well constructed, and the punctuation is very poor. And I was an English major, so, you know, I knew better than to take this big book to heart. So I took it down to the beach one day and I corrected it. And I fixed the sentences, you know, and I put in some more commas and parentheses and semicolons and, you know, just fixed it up, cleaned it up a little bit here. And I brought it down to the meeting in Serenity Hall in Whittier. And they asked me, they used to call you up to the podium to share, and I said my little piece, and then I said, you know, I don't think that this big book here that you talk about is very well written, so I have made some changes in that. So if you want to see me about that, you could see me after the meeting. And they all said, you know, I don't know how I ever did that, but, you know, it's so embarrassing to talk about it. I did. In fact, people will tell you this. They said, keep coming back, Dee. Thanks be to God. Thanks be to God that I kept coming back. And they were saying, get a sponsor. I did very poorly with sponsors at the beginning. I hired some women. I hired them on temporarily, you know, for temporary things.
I can still
and
get
then
to
I got rid of them when they were telling
drink.
Me things they didn't want to hear.
And then they were talking about the steps.
And of course, the steps were
to understand the difference
wall,
between
you know,
and only
all,
sobriety
on,
you know, I've
and
done
real
all that recovery.
You know, where I can
see, I happen to have this other addition to my disease of alcoholism.
And he said, I know a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I know a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I know a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I know a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little bit better than everybody, and he said, I feel a little everything that ever happens to me in my continued sobriety when I get stuck. And do I ever get stuck in my sobriety? My sponsor reminded me this morning, keep being current. Be current, you know. I was stuck last week because I had the flu. I don't get the flu. You know what I mean? I'm indomitable. So I don't know what to do with myself. I'm sick. You know, I just don't know. And everything I know goes out the window. I don't remember anything. I have the ism of the disease, incredibly short memory. You know, I forget everything. So this fellow in Serenity Hall said, why didn't you go home to your convent and kneel down and ask God to give you the willingness to change everything about you on the inside? Well, of course, I knew this would not work for me. It was too, you know, simplistic and too banal. I couldn't handle that very well. But if you're in emotional pain, you'll do almost anything. And I did that when I got home. And I was hoping that there would be a rainbow in the sky, or at least a burning bush, or some huge sign, as they say in Texas, from God. And there wasn't. In a couple of days, I was driving in heavy traffic on the 57 freeway, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and I saw the sunset. And it occurred to me when I saw the sunset that I hadn't thought of a drink for several days. And I knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the merciless obsession that's described in step one in our 12 and 12 was removed from me. I knew at that moment that something extraordinary had happened. I noticed in Bill's story that when he asked God to remove his defects of character, root and branch, I'm always fascinated by that because I often wonder, how do you get the root and the branch stuff out? Well, Bill doesn't tell us that the root and branch stuff got removed, but he does tell us in that story that he didn't have a thought of a drink, and he never drank after that. When he asked God to remove his defects of character, root and branch, that the obsession for alcohol then left him. And I started after that point to get extraordinarily excited about this deal. This deal, which in my way of thinking is the difference between only sobriety, only not drinking, and recovery. That comfort level that one can get through the complete and utter surrender, which I knew nothing about and didn't know how to do. And I talk these days a lot about letting go, as we heard read in chapter 5, letting go absolutely. Don't you wonder sometimes at the superlatives that are in that chapter? You know, absolutely, rigorous honesty. What it asks everything of us. I talk about letting go absolutely with panache, with a bit of flair. You know, the panache was the helmet that the French soldiers wore when they went to war, and they were easily distinguished by the flare on the feather on their helmets. And I have come to believe that there is a difference, there's a huge difference, in the way we wear this deal called sobriety or recovery. I believe that I know for sure that the way that I want to wear it is that I want to travel in this deal. I want to travel first class inside. I really do. Now, in my lifetime, I fly someplace almost every single week, but I hardly ever, in fact, only once in my whole life did I ever fly first class, and that was a mistake. Somebody had the same seat as I had, and they looked at me and they thought, she's an old lady, so we'll put her up to first class. So they did that one time, and I was amazed when I went in the first class place because it was very different from economy. And what they did was they gave me a duvet to put over my lap instead of a blanket, and they gave me all sorts of little goodies. And then a lady knelt down at my side and she wanted to know if I needed a manicure or a massage. And I thought I must have died and went to heaven. And when I got as far as Heathrow, London, this is what occurred to me. We all got to Heathrow. We all got there. But I got to travel first class. And that's what I want to do in this deal called the Travel in Recovery. I want to be able to do this thing with some kind of class and comfort and style. And the only way I know how to do it is through the daily application of the steps and the recognition of the delights and the goodness and the gifts that have been offered to me through the steps and in the promises. See, what I didn't know was written on page 61, where it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is my problem. I didn't know that for a long, long time. I didn't know how to identify that. And then at the very bottom of that page, on page 60, it says, this is the how and the why of it. You have to quit playing God because it doesn't work. Oh, well, I didn't think I was God, but I surely thought I was Mrs. God. I'd given my life, you know, so there were a ring on my finger to say that I've dedicated my whole life to God, so I was Mrs. God. So I just clicked my fingers and I told God what to do. I had no clue that I was playing God. You have to quit playing God because it doesn't work. And then it goes on to say that hereafter in this drama of life, wasn't it amazing how they knew that we were such dramatic people? In this drama of life, that God's going to be in charge. He's the principal, I'm the agent, he's the father or the mother or the parent, and I'm his child. And then the fabulous sentence that says, most good ideas are simple. It was so simple for me, ladies and gentlemen, that I almost missed it. I almost missed this deal. And this concept that God is in charge is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which I was going to pass to freedom. And I had no idea about any of that until I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nor did I know what it would say then on page 63 there, when we sincerely take this position, all sorts of remarkable things will follow. And the 13 promises of step 3 are enumerated there all down the page, beginning at the top there on page 62. I'll have a new employer, and this new employer will provide what I need if I stay close and perform his work well. And I was to ask my sponsor, well, you know, what does that mean for me? I thought I was doing God's work. And God's work for me, I was told, was to stay sober. Not only physically sober, but emotionally sober, which for me is the difference between only sobriety and into deep recovery. And if I stay emotionally sober, I have to do what it says on page 55. I have to find this great reality, this higher power, not out there, not over there, not in where my good old ideas told me God was, but I have to find this higher power deep down within. Now that was a whole new concept for me in this deal. I had no clue. I didn't know that in order to find my higher power, that I would have to go deep into the inner recesses of myself to find out who I was. And that I would, in the middle of all that junk, that I would... You see, I spent all these years trying to be good for God. Can you imagine doing this? And I was to come to people like you and to learn that I was just fine as I was. And I found the difference then between the arrangement and the relationship with God. And I found the difference between just, you know, this unsatisfactory way of living to wonderful fourth dimension experiences, plummeted into the fourth dimension through the gift of the program. I do believe that when I really, really, really found God, it was when I was introduced to step 7. And I said the words on the top of page 76 where it says, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. And I think I heard God saying, B, are you sure? Are you sure that you don't have to impress me anymore? Or you don't have to be good for me anymore? Or you don't have to feel worthy anymore? That you're just okay the way you are. And then I understood something extraordinary. I understood what I'd been teaching people for years before. I had taught people forever, you know, how to interpret scripture and how to put their own name in there and how to believe that God was speaking directly to you. And I taught people, you know, the different passages in scripture and how to say, you know, using your own name in there, I've loved you with an everlasting love and I am constant in my affection for you. Or I have carved your name on the palm of my hand. Or I've stored up your tears and I put them into a little bottle. A delightful, endearing image of God loving us so much. And I taught other people that. but I didn't believe that I quite fitted into that category until I took step seven. And when I took step seven, I knew that I fitted into that category. And I knew at that moment, internally, I knew experientially about the unconditional love of a higher power. My belief today is that I don't know that I would ever have experienced that if I hadn't experienced the love and the unconditionality of the women and men of Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me that all-embracing love, that it didn't matter what I was doing, if I was crying, if I was arrogant, if I was doing a temper tantrum, no matter where I was at, I was loved and appreciated and honored for who I was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had never found an environment where that was true for me until I met people like you. I will always be grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I didn't think I'd tell you this, but a week from today I will turn 70. And Thank you. Thank you. And so, all things being equal, I don't know how long more God has ordained for me to be here. But I do know that with every breath that I will breathe between now and my last one, it will be in gratitude for what I've been given, for the mystery of this deal, because this is highly mysterious. This program is offered to me through people that I would never have known. I had this experience last week when I had the flu. I was climbing the walls. I found a meeting that I'd never been to before. You know how scary it is to go to a meeting, you know, that you've never been to before, and you know that you won't fit and nobody knows you. And, oh, it's terrible. I go to this meeting and I find a newcomer, and she's telling me how terribly difficult she's finding the program and everything. And then she says this magical thing to me. At 26 and a half years sober, she says this to me. Well, she says, my sponsor tells me that there's nothing that a little bit of correct action won't fix. And I'm thinking, whoops, where'd she hear that? You know, she must have some sponsor. And I suddenly realize, you know, that I know nothing. I absolutely know nothing. The mystery of it is, you see, there's a wonderful quote I usually quote from King Lear, where he was in Shakespeare's play, where he's going into prison, and he speaks to his daughter Cordelia, and he says this: "We shall laugh and play and sing and tell old tales and look at gilded butterflies, and tell old tales of who's in and who's out, and take upon us the mystery of things as though we were God's spies." And I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous that we get to take upon us the mystery of things, because I have no clue how any of it works, how any of it happens. It's all opposite to what my brain would tell me. It's all opposite to everything. And to watch God working and to watch people change and to involve myself and ourselves in the mystery of this thing called the gift of the program. I thank you for your kind attention to me and for listening and for inviting me here. I especially thank my wonderful little driver, Lara. She's been fabulous, took wonderful care of me. And I'd like to leave you with a couple of words that one of the fellows in my home group says regularly. He says, buy the whole package. The difference between sobriety and recovery. Buy the whole package. Get to the sunny side of the street and have a zippity-doo-dah day. God bless you.